You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. KPCW News time is 8:06. Let's take a look at our weather here. Right now, it's 43 degrees here in Park City. The forecast for today calls for some widespread smoke before noon, then sunny with a high near 75, south-southwest winds 9 to 14 miles an hour. Tonight, again, widespread smoke after midnight, partly cloudy with a low around 50. As far as Saturday, again, widespread smoke before noon, partly sunny with a high near 74. You know, you look at the seven-day forecast, and it kind of reminds you of those days when we had those wonderful winter storms, except instead of snow every day, we got smoke every day. Let's see what we got for Heber. Right now, it's 39 degrees in Heber. Again, Heber has a similar forecast, a high of 80 today, but once again, smoke, then sunny. Low tonight around 40, and widespread smoke again tonight. And Saturday, widespread smoke before noon. As Deer Valley seeks approval of its plans for a new village base area, the Park City Planning Commission's focus is on how visitors and day skiers will get to the resort. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has the details.
In a brief meeting Wednesday, Park City Planning Commissioners provided some initial feedback to Deer Valley officials about the ski resort's plan to build a new village complete with hotel rooms and restaurants on the existing snowpark parking lots. Deer Valley wants the commission to approve the transformational project in two phases. First up for review is a three-story underground parking garage with nearly 2,000 spaces. The ski resort's application for the second phase, which includes residential units and commercial space, could come later this year, according to a staff report. On Wednesday, Planning Commissioner Laura Susser said not knowing the exact plans for the buildings above the parking garage during the first approval process may provide some difficulties.
Getting to an approval point for the parking garage without knowing what the uses are is, I think, going to be an ongoing struggle.
Susser asked for Deer Valley to return to the next meeting with more details about building occupancies and other traffic data. The ski resort said it is considering several measures to curtail single occupancy drivers coming to the redeveloped base area, which is expected to generate over 800 new daily trips to Snowpark. Such measures include paid parking, parking reservations, and potential hotel shuttles. Commissioner John Frontero, along with other members, said expanding shuttle service should be a priority.
Maybe you have a pilot program for a year or two, and you have six shuttles that move through town in the early morning and in the evening. And the goal is to reduce single occupancy vehicles. And so I think you have a lot of tools that are available, and I believe you'll need to use all the tools available. And I think the shuttles, I see that as an excellent tool to be able to move locals around.
According to data shared at Wednesday's meeting, nearly 60% of guests get to Deer Valley today by driving alone. Around 13% use public transit and 15% carpool. The commission also asked resort officials to return with more information about ski school drop-off and the proposed traffic changes for the Deer Valley Drive loop. The project is set for a special commission meeting October 30th. The Snowpark Village proposal will be the sole focus of that discussion. According to a timeline from city officials, a vote on the parking garage could occur as soon as December. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Well, the Park Record and the Park City Community Foundation are partnering with KPCW to help voters get to know this year's candidate for school boards in Summit County. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more on Monday night's forum.
The forum will be at the Park City Hospital's Blair Education Center from 6 to 8 p.m. School board candidates in Summit County's three school districts, North, South Summit, and Park City, have been invited. Board of Education seats are districted, meaning each candidate represents a portion of their particular area. Seats 1, 2, and 3 are on the ballot in all three districts. South Summit is also voting for seat 5. Those mostly cover Eastern Summit County's incorporated areas, that's Hennifer, Colville, Hoytsville, Oakley, Camas, and Francis, plus Woodland. In the Park City School District, those seats include everything south of Interstate 80, except Pine Brook and Summit Park. At the forum, candidates will deliver opening and closing remarks and answer questions from moderators and the audience. The forum will be recorded and streamed live on KPCW's Facebook page. Mail-in ballots go out the next day, on Tuesday. The general election is November 5th. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
A new luxury condo development next to Deer Valley's Mountaineer Express lift is expected to open at the end of the year. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has the details.
According to details shared at the Park City Planning Commission meeting Wednesday, the first phase of the development, called Founders Place, is expected to open at the end of this year with 32 units. It's located just next to Deer Hollow Road and the Mountaineer Express Lift at Deer Valley Resort. The second phase of the project, with 19 units, is expected to be complete next summer. The Planning Commission approved the first two phases of Founders Place in 2022, and on Wednesday approved the third phase. That'll include 24 units and will be on the other side of Deer Hollow Road. The developer plans to construct a pedestrian bridge over the road to connect the entire complex. The third phase is projected to be finished after the 2026-27 ski season. According to the Founders Place website, all of the units in Phase 1 and 2 have been sold. Along with the market-rate units, the project will include 6 affordable housing units in total. The development agreement for the property also outlines that a small portion of the purchase price for each condo is directed to Park City's Affordable Housing Fund. Founders Place project manager Carter Lamb said they expect to generate over $5 million for the Affordable Housing Fund by 2040. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
And we want to report that last night, civil authorities issued an immediate evacuation order for Summit, Utah. It began at 9:44 last night. It was scheduled to end at 3:44 this morning. Due to the rapidly moving Yellow Lake fire, this was an immediate evacuation for the area north of Mirror Lake Highway near the Yellow Pine Trailhead at mile marker 6 and Highline Trail at mile marker 34. Residents were supposed to grab their belongings and leave the area immediately. We'll try to follow up and see, make sure the status of that later on in this broadcast. Right now, I want to tell you what's coming up. South Summit Superintendent Greg Mon is going to be chatting with us about what's happening in that school district. Then I'm going to be joined in the studio by Park City Council member Ryan Dickey. He's going to give us a debrief from last night's city council meeting. We're going to finish our hour with Callie Birdsall, Chambers of Encircle, to update us on events at Encircle, including their upcoming Halloween carnival. Please stay tuned. Well, the South Summit School District held its regular meeting last night. Here with an update is School Superintendent Greg Mon. Morning, Greg.
Good morning. How are you?
Thanks for joining us. So, Greg, school year is off to a new start. Anything particularly exciting going on that we want to start with?
Well, it's a great start. We've had a great start to the year. Love having the kids back in the buildings. You know, it's...
The buildings kind of come alive. Like, they
do.
Probably seem kind of dead during the summer. And
yeah.
Then kaboom, right?
Yeah, it's funny because there's a lot going on in the buildings over the summer, you know, with cleaning and repairs and just upkeep, you know, and that. But it's a different kind of alive. And, once the kids start coming back into the buildings, it breathes a whole nother life into the school building. So, a lot of fun.
You know, even for those of us not in education, there still is a certain rhythm of life that when the fall comes, you think about school, you think about a new year.
That's right. Yep.
Greg, all right. So, what are we looking at in terms of changes in the district? What were your enrollment numbers like this year?
Well, our enrollment, it went down some. You know, as you probably know, we are based off of October 1 counts. And so our enrollment was down this year, and there are lots of, I think there are several factors that feed into that, but overall, across the district, we were down 61 students, which, you know, if in a large district, that might not seem like a really big deal, but in a small district like South Summit, that, you know, we feel that, so...
And that means money, doesn't it? And doesn't that mean you lose several thousand dollars per student?
So with each student, you know, there's the WPU for each student. So you lose that for sure. And, you know, you could walk that down, you know, several steps beyond that. But, ultimately that's the impact that it has on a system.
And your board has to do budgets, and they presumably do budgets based on a projected number, and this is going to sort of diverge from that a little bit, I take it.
Yeah, I mean, sure.
Yeah,
you know, just like
math.
It's math. just like if the enrollment numbers went up,
right?
You know, then there's a happy accident there. But
61, and in your district, what does that represent as an approximate percentage of your total student population?
We were at about 1,650-ish before, and we're 1,640 or so.
Okay.
So we're down high 1,500s. Mm-hmm. It's not like that's all in one building. It's kind of spread across several buildings. And so it's an impact that is felt across the board.
And that was kind of my next question, which is when we look at a decline like that, you're sort of curious about the why. And my next question was sort of, how did that break between elementary, middle, and high?
So we not only have our, you know, the break between elementary, middle, and high, but we also have our Silver Creek, the schools in Silver Creek, and then mm-hmm. we have the Camas Valley schools. So there's also a break there as well. But our elementary schools were down. Our South Summit High School had the highest enrollment drop. And that happens just you have different classes that are bigger than others. And so if you have a large group of seniors graduate and a small group of ninth graders coming in, that, like you said before, that's math. that's the easiest kind of applied math to get. Right. So, we also saw fewer kids in elementary as well. Our middle schools, they held pretty steady, but we saw the change at the elementary and the high school mainly.
Are you reading any sort of long-term implications for county school-age population from this, or is it not enough to draw any sort of?
Well, I think there are several factors. One, the average birth
right,
rate is down,
mm-hmm.
Which that's true, across the nation, but in a state like Utah, where our birth rate was so much higher than the average, and we're a little closer to that average now, so we're going to feel it a little more there. But we also we're seeing there are plenty of new developments within our district boundaries, but a lot of those are actually ending up being second homes or people who are retired or whatnot. They just don't have kids. That's a cycle that is not uncommon for school districts to go through. For us, we feel it in our whole district, whereas if we were on the Wasatch Front, we would feel it in certain neighborhoods.
And there's a big story in the Wall Street Journal this morning about people moving from Park City into areas like Camas and Heber and Midway.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I suspect a lot of those people are not, with school-age children.
Yep.
And so I know one of the topics that came up last night was the issue of open and closed enrollment. First of all, what does that mean?
Well, so Utah is an open enrollment state. So a school board determines if schools are at capacity or not. If they're at a certain capacity, then a board would designate a school as closed to open enrollment, meaning students that want to attend that school from outside of that school's boundary, they would not, the application process wouldn't even be opened for that school. So they would be closed. If a school is not at a particular capacity, then the board really should declare that school is open because we're an open enrollment state. And so what that means is if there are families that want to attend that school and it's been declared as open, then they go through an application process to be able to get a special permit to attend.
Now, does that student have to be within your school district, or can it be any student in the state of Utah?
Any student in the state of Utah.
Okay. And so where do you stand with respect to the various schools within the district? Are any of them open at this point?
So last night our board took action and declared all of our schools is open. Mm-hmm. We have the space and the capacity to have that be the case. And we do get all of our schools get applications.
Sure.
Our schools in Silver Creek tend to get more applications just because of their location. A lot of times in our Camas Valley schools, the applications that they're getting are kids that are, it's actually close, they live closer to our schools than they do to their district schools. So for example, Wasatch, the boundaries between Wasatch and South Summit, it's not like they're really clear, distinct, straight lines. They deviate, they go all over the place. And so there are kids that it's faster for them. They're closer to South Summit schools than they are to Wasatch.
And again, with that decision by the board last night, and given that it's middle of October, are you likely to see any additional applications for this school year, or is it probably over?
Well, so open enrollment, actually, it's only for a few months. It's just getting ready to open it up, and it will
for next year.
For next year.
Got it.
And so it's open for a couple months, and then it's closed. And then anything outside of that window mm-hmm. is considered late enrollment. So you can still apply, mm-hmm. but where you're applying for the following year, you're not going to get an answer until closer to the end of that current school year.
Now, did this represent a change? Were these schools considered open last year for this year's enrollment?
Yes.
Okay. And what kind of numbers did you see? What kind of numbers are you getting from outside the district?
Well, we've got, our Silver Creek schools, a lot of...
Define what those are.
So Silver Summit Elementary, Silver Summit Academy, mm-hmm. They have a much higher percentage of students that are on open enrollment.
Sure.
Just because of the proximity to the Park City School District, mm-hmm. And so their numbers are obviously much higher than our Camas Valley schools. Most of our students that are on open enrollment from, in our Camas Valley schools are coming from Woodland, the part of Woodland that's in Wasatch District. So
and anybody who's ever driven down 248 and said you're leaving Summit County, you're in Wasatch County, you're leaving Summit County,
you
can have a sense of just how irregular
yes.
those boundaries are with
yep.
this, which is probably the runs this. I know that you mentioned that before we got on the broadcast, you mentioned that you got a report from the IT department last night.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Well, not everybody thinks the world of IT is fascinating and just, cutting edge and everything else, but it really is. They reported out on a lot of the efforts that we're making on making sure we're in compliance with all of the safety requirements when it comes to technology. But one of the things that they talked about that was really exciting, we've been working on creating... it's called Performance Matters is what it is, and it's a tool that teachers are able to use to help assess kids at different levels of rigor and different depths of knowledge, and it's actually a tool that teachers are also able to use to identify areas that they want to get better at in their instruction. And so what was neat last night about that presentation was it's not often, in fact, this is the first district that I've worked in where we've been able to really show people how every department in a district actually does reach down to the individual classroom level. If we didn't have, when you think of an IT department, you think, yeah, they keep the iPads going, they keep the computers right. going for the kids and that. But in this example, they're actually helping support teachers in improving instruction for kids.
While we're on IT, I want to ask you this question. My sense is that there continues to be a technological challenge for teachers with respect to students' use of AI. Can you talk a little bit about, the kinds of steps you're taking to sort of, I know that as an adolescent high schooler, there'd been a tool that would write the report for me. I would have been pretty tempted to get that to spit it out. And I suspect I'm not the only one who's like that in the current generation. Is that a real problem, and what are you guys doing about it?
Well, I can tell you from my generation, I wish there was something that wrote my dissertation, but... I imagine it's probably a lot how educators felt when calculators were coming out.
Yeah.
This is going to make it so kids can't think. They can't think for themselves, that kind of stuff. And that's just not true. How you use it is what will determine the impact. And so we have teachers that are engaging the kids in the use of AI and using AI to help students see how they can improve, things like that. So I remember, about 2 years or so ago, when ChatGPT, that was the big first one that I heard about, and everyone thought the sky was falling and, kids are going to cheat and this and that. Well, certainly, kids were cheating long before AI. you know, but not that they ever cheated in our generation.
No, of course not. And certainly not in your school system.
Certainly not. But yeah, so really I think I've been really proud of our teachers and our leaders to be able to say, okay, this is not going to go away. And it's likely to become a bigger thing that kids are going to need to know how to utilize. And so how do we as teachers and leaders help facilitate that rather than fight that?
Are you seeing teachers demanding students do more physically in the classroom? In other words, to try to preclude the use of an AI to help do the work for them?
I do think there is some of that.
Yeah, I would think
but
so.
A lot of it comes down to what the learning intentions are.
Right.
You know, and what those performance indicators are going to be. So there, it really comes down to the individual teacher and the individual assignment and really what core standard skill are they trying to do to get the kids to be able to show mastery. And so you see more of that showing the mastery at times, you know, in the classroom. But again, it's just how they're taking what at first was viewed as really scary and, you know, gonna end education. And now it's like, oh, actually it's enhancing.
Okay, Greg, anything else we want to touch on before we go?
Anything you want.
All right, Greg. Thanks for spending time with us.
We'll
see you again next month.
Thanks.
We'll be right back after this. I'm joined now in the studio by Ryan Dickey. Last night, the Park City Council had its regular meeting. Good morning, Ryan.
Hey, good morning, Roger.
Ryan, I want to ask you about this morning's Wall Street Journal story about how people are leaving Park City for the suburbs, but we'll get to that in a minute. Did you have a chance to read that?
Only 11 or 12 people sent me the headline, but I haven't read the story.
Okay, so I can't ask you about it. So I'm not going to ask you about a story you haven't read, but it was pretty interesting, and I think it's going to be, a lot of people are going to be talking about it this morning here in town. I know last night, council considered a request to remove 37 Hillside Avenue from the Park City Historic Sites inventory. First, can you explain what that means?
Sure. We have a historic sites inventory that essentially goes through our historic district in Old Town and identifies sites which are, you know, essentially longstanding and in a historic form. We have buildings like the one we discussed last night that's was built in 1885 and survived the Great Fire, unlike 200 other buildings in town. So really represents a period in town that not many other buildings represent. So we actually have on the planning department website an amazing registry that describes each of the properties, its history, its owners, how it was used. And then, of course, we have a historic preservation board that manages those sites. So when the owner comes in and wants to make a modification or a remodel or an addition, those first go through our historic preservation board. They make a determination about its form and its style. And so there are a lot of restrictions on these historic properties, though they also enjoy a lot of benefits in terms of not having to comply with height and setbacks and parking and something that new construction might. So there are costs and benefits. So I think our historic district dates back to early 90s. We started identifying historic sites. This one was first identified in 1982 as historic. So overall, the historic district, I think, you know, is just a jewel of Park City and something that I think we're all proud of, but that can be a burden to an individual property owner.
And just crudely, does this generally mean that you're more likely to be able to do stuff that doesn't change the exterior of the building?
That's right. You know, it's difficult to change the existing form of the building, although you can do an addition. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the rules or the code recognizes that most of these buildings have had additions over time. So if you find a structure from the late 1800s, you can almost guarantee that somebody did an addition over time. This home built in 1885, I think, had an addition in the 1930s. And so there's a little bit of an opportunity to pick a period in time to replicate in the in the addition.
And something tells me that many of those additions probably did not go through detailed code review at the time.
I don't believe so.
Okay, so what was the issue on Hillside last night?
So issue on Hillside, this is a structure that was described as uninhabitable. It's, the building's in rough shape. It needs a lot of investment. The property owner wished to, says, hey, sort of colloquially, this house has kind of fallen down. It's reached its end of its useful life. I'd like to remove it from the historic registry so that I can do what I'd like with it. you know, this isn't the first property owner to come to the city with this request. And over time, we've, as a city, have taken the position we want those historic buildings to be restored and to remain and to keep the pieces that we can and to maintain the form of those buildings. So the request was to remove the house from the registry.
Completely. Which would, I assume, enable you to bulldoze it if you wanted to.
Yes.
Okay. Is that what they wanted to do, or did they say?
They didn't discuss their plans. The request was specific to removing it from the registry, though that's, you know, what you'd expect given the current state of the building.
And how big is the lot?
I don't know the size of the lot.
Is it one of these old town lots? It's probably a tiny old town lot.
Yeah. It's on hillside. It's a tiny home. Mm-hmm. There's since been a retaining wall that's at street level, and you can see the steps up to the house. But that's really no different than the state. A lot of the homes in Prospect were on, and since those property owners have since restored them. And these properties are valuable for their location. A lot of owners or purchasers will seek out these historic homes because they appreciate the value. So it's not as if this is a home that needs to be condemned and will be given away or gone to waste.
It could be restored.
It absolutely could be restored.
And what was the decision?
The decision was to not remove it from the historic registry, although you know, not without sympathy for the property owner. A historic district, by definition, is sort of an infringement on people's property rights. It restricts what you can do with your property. So, and especially, it can really feel like a burden when, like this family, you've had this house in the family for 90 years. Right. You owned it before this was a historic district. So, you know, in this case, a municipality comes in and puts restrictions on your property rights. And that's what property owners throughout Old Town face. We made the decision to do that, but this is now decades ago. Most of these historic sites have been restored, and we have the historic district we have today, which benefits all of us, but we do recognize that's a burden on individual owners.
Now, is this the type of decision that can be appealed?
That's a good question, Roger. I don't know if there's an appeal path.
You probably have to sue,
but
I don't know that there's a jurisdictional hook for that. So
I'm not sure. Okay. I think you could probably challenge the determination, but I don't know what that path would be.
Okay. Anything else you want to touch on that?
No, I think you covered it.
Let's talk about. I understood you heard a presentation regarding the senior center. Was that just sort of like an annual report, or is there a decision in front of the council on that?
No decision. It was an annual report that we get from the senior center, which the senior center exists as a result of an MOU between the county, city, and the senior center organization itself. So they come give us an annual update and talk about what they're doing. The senior center has had almost doubled its membership in the last 2 years. They're bursting at the seams for space, still trying to stand up more programs. I think they have 605 members and space for lunch for 60 people. So we have an RFP out on the street to build a new senior center with housing next to it. The seniors want us to have gotten that done yesterday. We have responses back on that RFP, and so we'll be discussing that in public.
I looked at the presentation, and they had some pretty large ambitions in terms of hiring more staff and growing the program. Where's the money for that going to come from?
That's a great question, and that's something we need to discuss. We're probably going to need to involve the county in that discussion. You know, today, the city owns the property. We provide some grant funding. The seniors own the building, and the county funds most of its operations. The seniors, I think the original ask and what we saw last night was something more on the order of like a 15,000 square foot building and then 50 units of housing. These are really big numbers, and it's a sophisticated development to do in Old Town. So big capital and then big operations. So that's a bit of an open question.
And the senior center, just so I understand it, is it an independent 501c3?
It's an independent organization.
And just essentially has relationships with the city and the county.
That's correct.
Okay. Big ask that we just talked about, where's the process from here in terms of responding to their request? How's that going to work?
So essentially, we've been responsive to their request.
Right.
So that request is outstanding.
But is that for a 15,000 square foot facility?
We didn't put, I don't think we had specific parameters around size, but we generally described that we wanted a combination of housing and a senior center and described the facility in a way that it's obviously something major. The RFP responses, I think we'll get various options through that.
Is this kind of like the the Bonanza Park District, we're going to do a sort of a multi-step. Give me a conceptual response, and then we'll work through the next stage. Basically right.
That's basically right. And so then we'll evaluate the responses to say, what do we like best? Are any of these feasible? Where are we on costs? You can pick a party to work with from there. We can we could modify the request. We could bring in other parties. There'll be a bit of a read and react to what we get back.
And this kind of relates to the Wall Street Journal story that you haven't read. The larger question of aging in place, sort of access to housing for seniors. This is obviously a bigger question. I believe that there aren't a lot of sort of assisted living or similar facilities anywhere near us. Is this something that the city and the county are looking at in terms of a problem?
It is a problem. It's something that I know the county is looking at and has discussed sites for assisted living, and I'm thinking about memory care. I know I've seen that in the press, just like anyone else, sort of in the sites in Kimball Junction. It's not something that I think as a city we've actively worked on, but it's in the ether for sure.
Okay, and given our sort of space constraint, it's not an obvious candidate for something within city limits, I wouldn't think.
It's not an obvious place, and it's true for seniors. This is a tough place to downsize. Your space doesn't necessarily get a whole lot less expensive as you make it smaller.
And I mentioned Bonanza. Any update on what's going on there?
RFP is on the street,
right?
And we, credit to our city staff, we have made a push to get this RFP seen everywhere. So we've gotten calls from Europe. It is out there. Folks know about it. This is a really high profile development project. So I think we're going to get great responses back.
When do they do?
I believe early November.
Okay, so, and then the evaluation period will take about how long, do you think?
I think through the end of the year is when we'll, I'd expect to talk about it in public before the end of the year.
Or early next year you'd have a decision, hopefully.
Hopefully so. I mean, we want to go.
This is the mayor's pedal to the metal philosophy. We're going to get it. At this point, you want to get it done.
We want to go, and we want to make decisions. We don't want to sit on it. We've gotten a lot of public feedback. We want to get responses back, get excited, and go.
You passed a resolution honoring Miles Redeman, which we seem to talk about a fair amount because he is worth talking about. Talk to us a little bit about his contributions to the community.
I mean, Miles is one of a kind, here for decades, comes from Crested Butte, plays a key role in shaping who we are, planning director, public affairs, started our leadership program. And I was thinking about Miles this morning and knowing that we'd talk about him. And reflecting on the fact that we can talk about Miles Redeman and not really have to describe who he is for this audience.
Yeah.
Everybody knows who Miles is. His contributions are immense. His son Bryce and his wife Joy were there last night. And Joy made, it was touching. She made comments that stuck with me about Miles, that he has lived a completely authentic life in Park City, that he is the same person at home who he is in public. And that in their time here, she has never heard him say a negative word about anyone in public or in private. And that's just how he lives. And, just that relentless positivity that you get from Miles and that community focus. It's never about him. Just someone we can all try to emulate a little bit in our own lives.
And his depth of knowledge. Like when you talk to him about the Olympics, the things that he can remember about the steps that they took and then try to relate that to the planning that has to go on now. I mean, he may be stepping down as the head of leadership, but he's not walking away from his community involvement in any way, as best I can tell.
He's not leaving town. He told us he'll be around. I think most of us told him that we don't believe him, that we know he'll be back. So we'll see if Miles can really walk away. And we also honored Jenny Dearson last night, who's been with the city for 10 years. Go ahead, Roger.
No, I was going to say, Jonathan Weidenhammer stole her away, didn't he?
He did, so we're going to have a little bit of a feud with Weeds. But she's moving on to an exciting opportunity in South Salt Lake. But when you think about, for so many people, Jenny is really the face of the city. It's who they interact with. They see her on Main Street. They're running an event. I mean, unless you pull a building permit, she might be your first interface with our city government. And what a great person to be with. Just relentless patience, always with a smile. She walks door to door in Old Town explaining what's going on with our events and with Sundance, and just tremendous respect and trust that we have for her in the community.
She is the face of calm during chaotic events. I mean, I've seen her sort of react to very upset people and calmly say, look, this is how it's going to work. And yeah, I think she's going to be sorely missed. That's a big spot to fill.
Yeah, it is a big spot to fill. Just the resident knowledge she has that she brings to the job. You know, John Greenfield spontaneously gave up and just paid this tribute to Jenny. He was wearing a tie, by the way, which was a little...
John Greenfield?
Yeah, John Greenfield was wearing a tie. We all were a little taken aback, so we hope not to see that again. But, you know, it was great. It was a really touching tribute. I think just everybody just has a soft spot for Jenny and the work she's done.
Yeah, she will be missed. Okay, before we go real quickly, you heard a presentation from the Arts Council. Anything significant to share from that?
The Arts Council presentation, unfortunately, there was an illness and they didn't make their presentation.
Okay, so they didn't hear one. But I was going off the agenda. I'm sorry.
Oh, sure, yeah. But we did talk about we made some updates to our public art policies, clarified and strengthened our percent for arts policies. So we'll continue to make 1% of every large capital project we do at the city over $1 million. 1% of that goes to public art, and we strengthened it to that as public art on site. So continuing to strengthen and support public art in Park City.
Before we go, Ryan, any indication as to when we're going to hear a decision about Sundance?
I don't know when we're going to have a decision. You know, we're just continuing to go through the process. And
is
so
there
far,
an ongoing
so,
process? Does dialogue continue at this point?
There is. There's an ongoing process, and you know, we're bound by some confidentiality agreements. But everything so far has been successful. Our partnership with Salt Lake has been really fruitful. I think it brings a lot to the table. We bring a lot together. So I'm going to remain optimistic until the end.
Okay. Anything else we need to touch on before we go, Ryan?
I think that's it. Thanks for having me.
Okay. We'll be right. Thanks, Ryan, for joining us this morning. We'll be right back after this. Encircle Hebrew is a community support an institution for LGBTQ plus youth. Here to update on activities at Encircle is Callie Birdsall Chambers, the Vice President of Marketing and Communications. Good morning, Callie.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us this morning. Callie, for those who aren't familiar with Encircle, let's start with an overview of it. What is Encircle?
So Encircle is Utah's largest LGBTQ plus youth organization. We serve youth, young adults, and families by providing life-affirming therapy, programming, and services for these individuals across the state. We welcome youth at any stage in their coming out journey, which today is actually National Coming Out Day. We welcome them along with members of their support system. They visit our homes. These are not homes that people traditionally live in, as people would think of when you hear home, but they look like home and feel like home for those who may not have that otherwise. So we have it's a safe space where people can come in during drop-in hours. We have art nights and music nights and family dinner nights. And then it's a place where they can experience the love and acceptance within Encircle's walls.
And I imagine that... when the first Encircle opened, and I understand there's more than one, this was seen as Utah's probably seen as a somewhat challenging environment for many of these youth. When was the first Encircle opened?
So the first Encircle opened on Valentine's Day in 2017, down in Provo. That was our very first home, followed by Salt Lake City and then St. George. And just last year, we opened Heber. It's a beautiful home on Main and Center up there, and if you haven't been, you should definitely come check it out.
Now, do we also have Alex Coutini on the phone with us?
We do. We have Alex Coutini, our brand new executive director, and he's joining us for the call as well.
Good morning, Alex.
Hi, Roger.
Welcome. And now, Alex, you just took on this job. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to Encircle.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm actually originally from Brazil, born and raised. I came to the U.S. about 15 years ago to go to college. I went to BYU, and then after I graduated from BYU, Idaho, actually, I moved to Salt Lake City. I've been in Salt Lake City for about 10 years. Right after graduating from college, I worked for Goldman Sachs, so I was in investment banking for about 8 years, started out as a junior analyst, moved my way up to vice president, and then when the opportunity came up a few months ago to join Encircle, I just knew instantly that that was exactly what I needed to do and where I should be. It was something that I've been wanting to do for quite a few years already. So when I had the opportunity, there was something inside of me that just immediately recognized that this is the kind of work that is kind of like my calling in life, really. I feel like to be able to show up for the youth and the families of the youth here in the state of Utah in a way that I wish that somebody had shown up for me when I was a young queer person growing up in Brazil and didn't have the support system that I wish that I had.
An interesting career path change from Goldman Sachs to Encircle, not one you hear about all the time.
I know.
Okay, so when did you start at the position?
About 4 months ago.
Okay. And tell us a little more. We talked a little bit about some of the programming at Heber. What have you found to be your most effective programming, and are there any things that you'd like to change going forward to add to your programming?
Yeah, so the interesting thing, in my opinion, about Encircle is that it's a therapy clinic combined with a resource center, right? So when you think about some of the experiences that these kids are going through, a lot of them are coming into the organization because of some sort of trauma. And when you think about trauma, it really involves a relationship. Right. Mm-hmm. So when you have a relationship that doesn't work out, whether it be with your parent or whether it be with a friend or anybody in your neighborhood or school. So if the wound, the trauma is a relationship, the healing of the wound also needs to be a relationship. So if somebody goes to a therapy clinic and they go through the experience of analyzing the things that they're going through, trying to understand themselves a little bit more, that will be a catalyst, and it'll be something that will be helpful to get the wheels turning so they can understand themselves a little bit more. But until they're right in front of another human being and have a relationship with somebody else that has a level of authenticity, of vulnerability, of trust, of emotional intimacy, not very much healing is afforded. So within Encircle, somebody can come from the therapy room, go down to the resource center, and be a part of any of the programs that we offer, ranging from art workshops or music workshops, friended circles that are really support groups where people can make friends and build relationships, and they have that chance to apply the things that they're learning while doing therapy, and really having an experience that's healing to them. Because for the first time, for a lot of these kids, they're building relationships with the core of who they really are, not with the presentational self that a lot of us in the community feel like we have to sustain in order to be palatable or show up and be safe within the communities that we're a part of.
So you're kind of describing what I would think of as a virtuous circle, that you have this sort of availability of therapy on the one hand, where you speak directly to the trauma, but then you segue that into these other activities that allow sort of people to be supported in their expressions of themselves. That seems like a pretty potent cocktail, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too. And I think in my mind, Encircle really is a celebration of authenticity, right? And I think that for me, I remember when I was growing up and for many years, I thought that authenticity was something that was kind of like a personality trait. Like you were an authentic person or you were not an authentic person. But the more I think about it and the more I grow in my experience as a human being, I realize that authenticity is a practice. It's a choice that you have to take every single day, and sometimes every single minute of every day. Okay. I remember when I was growing up and saying to people that I was wearing what I call the invisible armor. Mm. And even though it was invisible, it was still very heavy, psychologically, emotionally very heavy, because I was constantly aware of everything that I was doing, how I was moving my hands, how I was using my voice, how people were looking at me, did they think I was gay? And all of that was so exhausting. Carrying around that armor that you think is protecting you is actually so heavy that it's keeping you from flying. It's keeping you from having relationships that are genuine with other people. And then Encircle is, for a lot of these kids, the only place where they can come in, they can hang up that armor for the first time and still feel safe. They can exhale. And because the armor is off, the relationships that they're building are not relationships that are being built with the presentational self that is really not them, and it makes the relationship feel empty. They're building relationships with the core of who they really are, because at that point it's safe, and that's when it's really healing. So it's that perfect combination of something that offers the tools and the resources, again, like a catalyst that gets the wheels turning, gets you thinking about the process of unbecoming everything that you're not, so you can create space define who you really are and then be that person, celebrate that person that at some point in your life you thought needed to shrink or be muted or disappear. Then you come into this organization that tells you, no, actually, this is an opportunity to be celebrated. This is a person that needs to be loved and supported because everything that makes who you are is beautiful and worthy of celebration.
So how do you make yourself known to the community that you want to serve? Callie, what kind of outreach efforts have you made? Do you interact with the schools? What other organizations do you interact with to sort of make yourself known?
Yes, that's a great question. We do. We work with the local GSAs at the schools. We meet oftentimes with the schools, with the counseling offices there. We want to make sure everybody knows that we're available, so the parents know as well, because oftentimes we might have parents who maybe their child has recently come out and they're really ready to support them, but they don't know what that looks like. So sometimes we have a parent bringing a youth to Encircle for the first time, and sometimes it's a youth bringing a parent in. But we have those friendship circles that Alex talked about are so powerful because they are basically age, gender, and identity-based friendship circles that like a support group. And this is where some of these youth find friends for the very first time. A lot of families think, you know, I'm the only one who might have a queer kid, or I don't know what to do. And so we have those resources. And a lot of the times people attend our rainbow brunches, which we do have one coming up in Heber on the 2nd of November. That's a really good entry point into the community to come and just check out the home, have a tour, meet some of our staff, meet other people. In fact, tonight we have our Halloween carnival at the Heber home from 5:30 to 7:30. It's a free all ages event. It's a great time to just come, no pressure. Not that it's ever pressure coming to our homes, but it's kind of an easy entry point. Tonight has pizza, drinks, treats, pumpkin painting, carnival games. So just a fun way to come check out the home. And so I would really recommend, if anybody can tonight, come check that out. We have family dinner also on October 21st, so those are great.
It's a little early for Halloween, but is this a costume function?
Yeah, costumes are welcome, but not required. We definitely like to tone down the gore and, you know, violent costumes. But no, everybody's been chomping at the bit to get into the holiday season, so Halloween is officially underway. So, yes, absolutely encouraged.
And is this simultaneously a Halloween celebration, and are you also commemorating Coming Out Day?
Yes, absolutely. So today, National Coming Out Day, it's something celebrated every year where it's a chance for us to celebrate people being who they are authentically. And we celebrate those who have come out, maybe haven't come out, are trying to find the words and ways to come out, or the allies there to support those who do so. So really, it's just a great way to celebrate everyone coming into that authentic space bravely and courageously.
You know, this facility, I remember I had someone on the air when the facility was opening. And I guess I'm curious, how many, you know, what's your growth pattern been like? How many, I don't know what the right term is, clients do you serve, and how has it grown since you opened?
Sure. So Heber, you know, we're still in a growing phase at Heber. We have served over 16,000 visits. We've had people come to all four homes, and we provided 4,900 therapy sessions, including individual, family, couples, and telehealth visits in this year. I should have been more prepared for you. I apologize with the numbers for Heber alone. But we are seeing an uptick in visits, but we're always looking to get the word out. We know Heber's growing so quickly, and so if we can let people know that this resource exists, we're also always looking for volunteers. We have amazing volunteer opportunities that we often hear from our volunteers that it's more than just saving and impacting these youth lives. You're actually changing the volunteers' lives as well. It's so rewarding.
Now, I understand you're going to close the facility for the last weekend in October. What is that about?
So a lot of the times our staff needs to get ready for the upcoming seasons. They get a lot of the maintenance that needs to be done. Some of the things that just, when we're open all week long, sometimes things just need to shut down. It's kind of like when stores will do inventory, or some places will close down just briefly to do the business work at hand. So that's what we do, and our teams go through training. You can imagine a lot of our teams they're trained social workers. We have our therapists, so they go through professional development and training so we can offer the best services we have for our youth and our families.
Okay. Are there plans to open any additional locations in Utah?
Funny you ask. Ogden is actually under construction as we speak. It's our very first full build. It's not something that we renovated a home, so we're really excited about that up on Washington and 25th in Ogden.
Great. All right. Thanks for spending time with us. Anything else you want to touch on before we go?
I'll let Alex close that one out.
Well, I just wish everybody a very happy National Coming Out Day. And I think, like, the key word for me, Roger, when it comes to National Coming Out Day is really empathy. The people that come this organization in the process of killing themselves. Like, a lot of them will face a lot of struggles, a lot of shame. And the antidote to all of that and all of those really difficult feelings is really it's having people that are ready to feel with you, that are not sorry for you, but that feel with you because they know what the experience is like and they can hold up a torch and light up the way for the people that are starting that path right now. So I feel really grateful to be a part of this organization and really grateful for the opportunity to be with you this morning and spreading the word and helping people that need this service.
Okay. We've been speaking with Callie Birdsall Chambers and Alex Coutini, the new executive director of Encircle Heber. Thanks for spending time with us. I want to sort of repeat the information regarding the mandatory evacuation. Summit County Emergency Management has issued new mandatory evacuations for the Yellow Lake Fire overnight. Now, this is for the area north of Mirror Lake Highway between the Yellow Lake Pine Trailhead at mile marker 6 and the Highline Trailhead at mile marker 35. Anyone in that area has been ordered to leave immediately. Fire officers are asking people to only call 911 to report life-threatening emergencies right now. The non-emergency number is 435-615-3600. Complete evacuation information will continue to be available at kpcw.org. In Thursday night football, Park City dominated while Wasatch held on for a win. Bill Skinner has the recap.
At Dozier Field, the Park City Miners celebrated senior night with a commanding 49-10 victory over the Tooele Buffaloes. The Miners dominated the first half, racking up 42 points with explosive touchdowns of 37, 15, 62, 41, 62, and 35 yards. Defensively, they smothered the Buffaloes' strong rushing attack, holding them to just a field goal before halftime. In a shortened second half due to blowout rules, each team scored once in the fourth quarter to close out the game. The Miners are 8-1 and wrap up their regular season on Wednesday at 7 p.m. when they visit their Springville Red Devils. Catch all the action live here on KPCW. Meanwhile, the Wasatch Wasps jumped out to an early 20-0 lead before holding on for a 27-17 victory over the Cedar Valley Aviators. Despite the Aviators narrowing the score to within 3 points, the Wasps' defense stood firm, and a late touchdown sealed the win. Wasatch finishes their regular season with a 2-7 record.